open in us. This is a big experiment for the Oslo Pearlmongers. How to make something happen together with the other open source and free software communities in Norway. I hope you'll like it here. We have an interesting talk, and Larry will start off just after some small details for you guys. Right after Larry's talk, which he, as usual, will finish exactly on time. Okay.
I'm going to get my clock.
It's okay. Right after it, there's lunch. The lunch will be up in the lobby and upwards to where you came from at the theater there. After lunch, we're going up to the 11th floor on this building. There's a nice view there. Enjoy it. We'll have two tracks there, a smaller track today with Perl 6 related stuff, and the big room with Perl 5, modern Perl, and all kinds of other interesting stuff. We're guessing right now the capacity here, because we hoped quite a few more would tell us what kind of themes were interesting for you guys. So if it looks like we've put the wrong room, the wrong track in the wrong room, then we'll have to switch just to make it fun. Luckily, it's just a stair between the rooms. Other than that, I hope you've had an interesting start, and I'll leave the more interesting talking now to Larry.
Thank you.
Welcome to Oslo.
Okay. Thank you. I have been made to feel very welcome here. The title of this talk is, well, you can read. Well, when my father was growing up, he used to say, I have six little friends who tell me all I know. They are who, what, when, where, why, and how. Always bothered me that no doesn't rhyme with how. But if you think about it a little bit, laziness and impatience and hubris sort of map rather nicely onto these interrogative pronouns. Who can I get this to do instead of me? That's a lazy thing. What is the least I can get away with doing? When will it be done? Where are we? Are we there yet? That's impatience. Hubris is. What motivates me to do things? Why should I do this? Because, I'll get a swelled head or something like that. And how will I do it? Well, obviously by being insane. So, now, design of any sort is always a bit hubristic just by the nature of it. We're getting a little bit of feedback here. Could we cut down just a little bit? I think you can probably hear me back there okay, can you? Okay. There's this water. I'll speak up a bit. There's this waterfall chart that was the way you design things when I started off. Especially in government projects, which probably explains why most of them fail. You write your specification, you write design, you code, and you test. Nowadays, we get the extreme programming model, which just sort of turns everything on its end. You write your tests first, and when you're done testing, you can do your coding, and when you're done coding, you can do your design. And finally, when you're done designing, you can write the specification of what you actually wanted to do. But it's not an accident that this looks like a strange loop in a fractal sense, because there's feedback on various levels, butterflies flapping their wings and wind going around in circles, especially in government contracts, a lot of wind going around. But the idea one of the ideas of extreme programming is you ain't going to need it. You don't want to design something into your system that you aren't going to need. So, you know, design can be done lazily is one way to do it. And it's sort of differently hubristic from the waterfall chart. It's instead of, you know, the problem with the waterfall chart is you have to know beforehand. So you hubristically know, I know what the project has to do. With the other approach, you don't know that in advance, but you know that you will know when you get there. And so the problem, of course, in any case is how do you know when you do get there? You know, we thought we were there, kind of, with Perl. If you're into physics, you see these potential energy curves where, you know, the ball rolls up and down, and, you know, if it's not at the bottom, then obviously it's not stable. It wants to roll toward the stable point. If you're an economist, then just flip this upside down, and you talk about hill climbing algorithms instead. But same idea. But are you optimal when you're at the bottom? Well, you don't really know that, because you could be at a false minimum. You know, you might be happy, but you don't know that you might be happier down there. The problem is, you know, it takes a little energy to climb over that hill. Or if you're into quantum physics, you can be sneaky. We very much like quantum physics in this day and age. But you know, however you get there, it's what you call a promised land. Now, Perl 5, you know, it has a few of these false minima we discovered in syntax, semantics, pragmatics, discourse structure, implementation, documentation, culture. Other than that, it's perfect. We're getting there, though, in my hubristic opinion. And the way it started out was, you know, in the year 2000, we started to notice that we were having some growing pains, that certain aspects of the Perl design were reaching their limits. It was difficult to take the Perl 5 design further than we were taking it. And so we started thinking about, well, you know, what do we need to change? Maybe it's time to break a few things. We've kept backward compatibility for, you know, many, many years. And so we asked for some suggestions. We said, we're going to do Perl 6. What would you change? And I expected, well, maybe we'll get 20 RFCs. And we got 361. Now, those of you who are into mathematics will know that 361 is much larger than 20, which is what that lovely Unicode character means. So that, of course, was very shocking, and we took a while to recover from that. It was almost painful to realize, you know, how much pain there was that people were venting with those 361 RFCs. And the solutions were all over the map. We just really, it would have been a mess if we tried to implement all of those things in Perl 5, because they were all the suggestions were kind of had tunnel vision. Well, let's just change this one thing and leave everything else the same. Well, but you can't do that. You need a systematic design. So we instead of taking the solutions that were proposed, by and large, we ignored those and said, well, what is the pain point? What is the pain that is being caused, and why is that? And how can we hubristically do a design that will satisfy all of those pain points? So that says, what's next? Everything. No pressure, though. And we have not put pressure on ourselves in that sense. We're going to take the time to do it right. So we had various goals in the Perl 6 design. And of course, we want to support every programming paradigm out there, including the ones that aren't invented yet. Yeah, lots of buzzwords. We love buzzwords. Extensibility, reliability, maintainability, internationalization. Yeah. And with our goals, we had some meta goals. We wanted to have really good defaults this time. One of the big problems with the original Perl design is it gave you all this flexibility, but it didn't give you guidance in which one was perhaps the best way to do it for normal code, especially with the objects. And so everyone rolled their own. Other things that are each probably a talk in their own selves. Meta goal. This one's for the managers. Managing known and unknown complexities over time by enabling the community to mutate the gene pool of easy things. Meta goals is, of course, enjoy life. Hi. Wakarimashita. To optimize for fun. And particularly, one of the things that we find fun is pain. So there's this meta goal and this is essentially what the talk is about today. How do we actually design for laziness, impatience, and hubris in the future? And of course, I had to explain to my grandmother that when we say laziness, impatience, and hubris, it's sort of a joke. My understanding is the first edition of the Camel book, the translation into Japanese, they actually put a parenthetical note, this is a joke. we are very hardworking in how lazy we are, and we are very persistent in how impatient we are, and of course we're very humble about our pride. So, but this whole thing is, driven by ego. So how does that, what's that mean for Perl 6? For any language X, we want to be as good as X. No, that's a lie. We want to be a better X than X. So we want to be a better Java than Java, a better Ruby than Ruby, a better Python than Python, a better Lisp than Lisp, a better Haskell than Haskell. Well, maybe not that. We recognize that this is impossible. We are going to do it anyway. We will fail, but everyone will love our failure. We want to be the Martha Stewart of languages. That is to say, Martha Stewart is the woman who does everything better than you. Even goes to jail better than you, I guess. Paul Graham talks about a 100-year language. What is it about what will make a language that can last 100 years? Well, nobody knows, except that whatever we have, if something will last 100 years, it will evolve into what is 100 years from now. So you ask yourselves, were the dinosaurs successful? By some definition, they reigned over the rule for, 150 million years, or give or take. By another definition, we still have dinosaurs. I'm referring to the bird, not the project. I have to say that because Patrick's here. But yes, bird.
It's not my project.
Yeah. Yeah. Correct. Anyway, birds, arguably they adapted very well. The asteroid hit and they said, well, we better take to the air. So they were adaptable. So we want Perl 6 to be more adaptable than any language X. But what does that mean? Well, we've been working on these various implementations. My particular pet project has been the standard Perl 6 grammar, which is written in Perl 6. It's just a bunch of declarations there at the beginning. But the part I... parts I want to show you are up here near the beginning someplace is the resolution is not very large and it's kind of dim. Would it help to put the lights out up here? You don't have to look, well, you want to, yeah, okay. This is the precedence table. As you see, the various precedence levels there. What I wanted to actually show you was down here further. There's these syntactic categories like nouns and values and terms and numbers and infixes and postfixes. And then there are these rules, like, they have these strange names. There's a noun fattero, and there's a noun variable, and there's a noun package declarator. And all these are in the standard grammar. We'll talk about why that's important later. But the idea is that Perl 6 will be an easily mutated language. That is, of course, most mutations are lethal, I guess, but we don't want to have the lethal mutations. But the theory is that we could take a declaration and mutate Perl 6 into whatever language you want. So you could say, use COBOL, identification division, and on you go. Usage is computational. I don't know why you'd want to, but you can. I mean, they're all just domain-specific languages. To Perl 6, all the other languages are just sub-languages of Perl 6. They're just, that's hubris, okay? Let's talk a little bit about impatience, too. You know, everyone asks, well, your programmers, you say, when is Perl 6 going to be done? And of course, the standard answer is Christmas. We don't say which one. Now, you know, this promised land metaphor works very well in some ways. We started Perl 6 in the year 2000. The children of Israel wandered in the wilderness for 40 years before they got to the promised land. So we have until 2040 to finish, I hope. I'm rooting for getting done by 2014. My theory for this is, Perl 6 is sort of my big sequel to Perl 5, much as The Lord of the Rings was the big sequel to The Hobbit. And Tolkien took 14 years to write the Lord of the Rings, so that gives me a few more years here. Well, actually, we're making much better progress than that, I think, which you will hear about in this conference. Laziness. Of course, we all know what that means. Never put off till tomorrow that which you can put off till the day after. But it's really about efficiency when you're talking about it as a positive goal. In our design, what we want to do is reuse the concepts, and that is at least it will be lazy for the people learning the language to only have to learn particular concepts once instead of many different unrelated things. So a lot of what we've been doing is taking looking at some of the things in Perl 5 that people are used to them, but they're sort of low power constructs. They don't give you much bang for the buck, and how we can mutate those into things that are just as intuitive but are actually high-powered. Yeah. And only in this case, unlike Aladdin's lamp, it's the new lamps that have the better genie, we hope. Let me give you an example. In Perl 5, we have these glob file names, star.pl, match all the PL file names. And the angle brackets give you these semantics. But you don't use that very often in most programs. Much more often, you tend to use these QW quotes, which is a list of literals. Then you have other things that are like, an auto-quoting construct here in your hash subscript, but that doesn't work for a slice. You have to still quote those. Well, you know, there's some things going on there. It's kind of bad Huffman coding. The easy things should be easy, and the things you don't want to do so often, they can afford to be a little longer. So we demote the glob to be just glob. And instead, swipe those angle brackets for the QW kind of literal, and that's neat. We've actually been wanting to do that in Perl 5 since 15 years ago, and just never got around to it. But then we also demoted the hash subscript. It doesn't do autocoding anymore inside those curlies, so you don't have to guess whether auto quotes or not. But then you notice there's an interesting thing going on here. We have a literal way of having a list here. So we can just carry that idea over to hash subscripts. And so in Perl 6, if you want to have a literal hash subscript, you use the angle brackets just as you do the for the QW-like operator. And of course, the sigils have been rationalized too. But the idea is that you have the same construct, its syntax, and it's used in different contexts, and it means something slightly different, but it also means the same thing. It means here's a list of literal values. So,
what did you do with the curly bear word?
The curly?
Curly bear word.
Curly bear word now will treat that as real code inside always. Yeah. And generally, if it's not a real function, it will say, I don't recognize that function. And in fact, we can demonstrate this sort of thing. Suppose I say, and just forget. And I should have a nice little warning right here at the top. Before the symbol table dumped out, I should have used a different program. Yeah. Notice it says, undeclared routine right there at the bottom, ABC. So it'll tell you.
That seems like it's going to have some interesting effects once in a
while. Yeah. Well, never quote things that are routines. There it is. Anyway, the idea is that we take a principle and try to look for principles like this linguistic principle that we've just used that operate on many different levels. In natural linguistics, we have these form versus content distinctions at many different levels. Sometimes we call them etic versus emic distinctions, phonetics versus phonemics. There's syntax versus what the syntax means, all up and down. And so at many different levels in the language, we want to try and increase the power by conserving the number of ideas that are necessary. And this also makes it easy to learn. So, here's the standard recycling. Well, we have these variants, too. This means partially recycled paper. Don't confuse it with this, unless you want to die. Or this, unless you want to die differently. It's biohazard. So this is partially recycled paper, completely recycled paper. How are you supposed to tell these apart? It's bad design, I think. But anyway, I didn't design those. The basic thing that we've been striving for, that we use the word unifications for, we look for these underlying things that are really the same. We have a few of those in Perl 5. We talk about, a method is just a subroutine, and a class is just a package. And those are, kind of these fundamental, this is just one of those kind of things that are not obvious on the surface. So when are two things that look like separate things, when are they really the same thing? Electricity and magnetism, are they the same thing or are they different things? They used to think they were different, and then they unified them. And so this recycling idea, we have some ideas that are partially recycled into other ideas, some things where it's completely recycled, where we've managed to identify things almost completely. So, for example, on the comments, we've got this partial recycling thing going here, where we have the quoting syntax, which you can have quote and then brackets. And we've carried that over to have embedded quotes, so you can have comments, I should say. So you can have an embedded comment. If you start with a bracket after the comment character, then it's just delimited by that. And that also carries over. We have multiple brackets that will match and ignore single brackets inside, however many you want. And that carries over to comments, too, and any other bracketing characters. On the other hand, we did not carry over the quoting of non-bracket characters because we felt like that would be too... there are too many things that are commented out that are not bracketing characters. So we didn't carry that part. So there's sort of a partial match there. On the other hand, some things are completely unified going both ways. So we got partial unification with the quotes and comments. We borrowed some things. But with warnings and exceptions, we basically said, they're the same thing. The only difference between a warning and an exception is whether they are going to resume by default. But by unifying these things, instead of having a completely separate mechanism for dynamically scoping which warnings are emitted and which ones aren't, you can use exactly the same exception handlers that you use for normal exceptions, fatal exceptions. You can use the same kind of exception handlers for warnings in your dynamic scope and then just turn on or off whether they get emitted or not. You can turn warnings into fatal exceptions. You can turn fatal exceptions into warnings because they're so similar. Another place where we've inserted a lot of laziness is the is this idea of having a single parser that parses multiple languages. In the Perl 5 parser, we have all these sub-parsers that sort of do their own thing. You know, there's the standard language parser, and then you get inside strings and it has its own parser, and then the regular expressions have their own parser, and they just do their separate things. We decided that was a bad thing. We don't like to do double parsing, and we piece of text should never be in two different languages at once, unless you're, you know, specifically wanting to write that way. So, you know, here's a bit of Perl 5 code, and it will be difficult for you to see what the difficulty with it is. So let me highlight in red, which you all still can't see. But if you see the slash here in the comment, this is extended syntax, so we're allowed to have comments from the X down there. But the fact is, it's going to see that slash up there at the top and find the slash in the middle, and it's going to think that's the end of the string, and then it's going to get a parser failure. Oops. That's because we're treating it as two different languages. First we treat it as a string, and then we treat it as regular expressions. In Perl 6, you don't have that problem. First of all, you don't need the X because that's the default. And it's a real language. It's not a string. So we have this notion that the particular lexical scope, and we're even inside those slashes, we consider that to be a lexical scope of sorts. It has its own language, and every time when it drops into the slash, it's in a different language. When it sees the comment character, it's in the language of comments. But that comment language is shared among all the different sub-languages. So there's this polymorphism going where, you know, a regular expression comment and a Perl comment are really the same language, and they are shared polymorphically. If we have time, we can go into that at the end. So lazy list, never put off till tomorrow, which you can put off indefinitely or forever. So another unification that we have basically done in Perl 6 is to say lists by default are just iterators. You don't commit to how long the list is. There's this idea of laziness. I don't want to decide yet. In the case of a list, I don't want to decide how many values I will want yet. Maybe I want 5, maybe I want 5,000. But in Perl 5, list context is eager. You say, evaluate 1 to infinity, you're going to run out of memory. In Perl 6, no problem, because it doesn't. It just says, oh, I have an iterator that goes from 1 to infinity, and we don't know how many he wants yet. The whole idea of context is jet lag hits. I lose 42 hit points. So the context itself in Perl 6 is also lazy. In Perl 5, the compiler knows which expressions, for the most part, it knows at compile time which ones are in list context and which ones are in scalar context, which we renamed to item context. In Perl 6, this is also done lazily. So Perl 5 will know whether at bar at compile time is going to be evaluated as a list or not. So it ends up saying, well, if you're going to pop bar, then I want to treat the array as a single object. And if I'm going to say that, then it wants to flatten it out. We get the same effect in Perl 6, but it doesn't actually have to decide until it actually calls the function and binds its parameter list. And at that time, it can decide which context it's in and do the right thing. We call this lazy binding. It's another one of these ideas from quantum mechanics. The idea is, you know, you encapsulate a bunch of things into an entanglement of some sort, and then eventually you observe that entanglement and it collapses. The wave function collapses, as we say. And, you know, it's all transparent on our level, and hopefully on the level of the Perl programmer, typically, it's sort of transparent whether, you know, this thing stays entangled and eventually collapses at the time you do the call. But it's all, you know, the universe is lazy, so let's make Perl 6 lazy that way too. But beyond that, there's many other ways to say in Perl 6, well, I don't really want to decide that yet. It would be premature optimization. There's ways of saying, you decide, I don't want to decide. In particular, we've encoded that particular concept in this particular term. Now, if you use this as an operator, of course, it's still multiplication. But if you use it where it's expecting one of those nouns, a term in an expression, what it really means is whatever. This is a reusable concept. It means you decide, I don't want to decide. So, looks very much like some Perl 5 code that you might write, except that we require the comma in there because the closure is a real argument now. But notice this 0 dot dot star on the end there. That says 0 to whatever. That's literal Perl code, Perl 6 code, and it does the right thing. And you don't have to understand how it does the right thing. You know, cargo cult programming is okay. Baby talk is okay. But, you know, you guys are programmers, so you really want to know how it really works. Okay, well, when you say something like 0 to 10, in Perl 5, if you ran this, it would actually generate the number eagerly from 0 to 10. And just, or 0 to 10 million, or however many. In Perl 6, however, all operators are really just functions. That's another one of those unifications. So, The full name of the infix operator, if you called it, would be infix. And here's those angle brackets again being used to enclose something that's a literal in yet another form. This is called adverbial syntax. But leave that aside. Anyway, that's the name of it. And it has two arguments, 0 and 10. And the infix operator knows, if you get a 0 and a 10, that it wants the list from 0 to 10. So it does the right thing. It calls, it looks through all of its implementations of the range operator and says, oh, those are two integers. Let's call that one. That's what we call multiple dispatch. Now, when you say 0 to whatever, it actually calls with the arguments 0 and whatever. And that star has a type. And that type actually is named whatever. So it's type-based multiple dispatch, and star is a whatever. It happens to be in the only instance of the whatever class. So when you say 0 to star, it does that. But you know, you can also say a to whatever, and that's a different kind of infinity, isn't it? Well, that's no problem, but it matches on str and whatever instead when you're doing the multiple dispatch. So all of this stuff just naturally falls out of this basic underlying multiple dispatch paradigm that we're using and does the right thing. It doesn't have to be the range operator. You can say, now in Perl 5, we have one operator X that's overloaded for both kinds of repetition. In Perl 6, we split those. So the XX is a list list replication operator. So I can say, well, give me an arbitrary number of yeses in a list. Well, you know, why would you want that? Well, how many times have you wanted to initialize a slice of something in Perl 5? And you say, well, okay, I need to, you know, you could say yes multiplied by the number of keys, but maybe that's difficult to calculate. Here it just says, well, just make the right number of them and put them there. Don't make any more than you need. Now, you might look at that on the left there if you're a Perl 5 programmer and say, well, wait a minute, that's a slice. Isn't that supposed to be an at there on the front instead of the percent that we had? Well, no, we changed that. we have now what we call invariant sigils. The normal sigils are still the same. Scalars, arrays, and hashes, associative arrays. And those, of course, chose array because it's an A, and we chose the percent because it looks like a key value pair. I like visual puns. But in Perl 5, if you want to dereference those, it turns into a dollar sign. And we, at the time, we had a good reason for that, or at least we said we had a good reason for it. But it's backtracking. You get to the bracket, and you have to backtrack and reinterpret what that dollar means. So we just said, well, let's make it invariant. It's always the name that's the variable. So you don't have to do this mental backtracking anymore, and the computer doesn't have it. And there's no exceptions there. You don't have to memorize a list of exceptions. And the basic underlying unification is that a sigil plus a name is actually the name of the thing in the symbol table. Unlike in Perl 5, where there's this type glob thing, which you know, sort of implies sigils, but isn't really there. Another simplification. In Perl 5, a my variable extends to the end of its enclosing block, except that, well, if a my variable is declared in the control expression of certain multi-line constructs, if for a while, mumble, mumble, it only extends to the end of the first block of the multi-line construct and no further. Well, sometimes, maybe. It's a little simpler in Perl 6. A my variable extends to the end of its enclosing block and no further. Period, end of statement. There is no rule 2. We don't have a bunch of control structures that are exceptions to this. We're trying to get rid of those listed exceptions. We're trying to make things regular underneath where it matters. So we've looked at every operator and tried to make sure that they are all carrying their proper weight. They have the proper Huffman coding length, short things for common, longer things for not so common. And there are traps in the some of them we inherited from the C precedence table, for instance. So we have this new precedence table. Oh, where is the periodic table?
Right there, see it?
Where?
The second column to the right.
Second column to the right.
On the right, most of the way down.
From the right.
From the right, most of the way down. Do you see it?
It's the second from the bottom.
Third?
See the star
on
the rocket?
Got it. Okay. I have this lovely periodic table of the operators here. Hard, this is kind of low contrast, unfortunately, but we can zoom in here. I'm frequently asked which of these are radioactive. I believe they all are, actually. But anyway, one of the things that is infelicitous in Perl 5 is if a mathematician comes in and writes, well, dollar $x in the range between 1 and 10. Yeah, well, it'll parse, it'll run, it won't do what he expects it to do. In Perl 6 it does, because we have chained operators. Another unification that we had to do was to allow the second line there, to allow, well, if all these things in the chain sense are true. And the reason we had to unify that is in C, and hence in Perl, equality and inequality are different precedence levels. We've smashed them into one precedence level, and hey, less precedence. And then this works. So that is another little unification. Variables, we've thought a lot about those. Almost all the special variables are gone. The functionality is still there, but it's mostly it's attached to the right place. So instead of having these random variables that happen to affect the current output handle or the current input handle, whatever that happens to be, they're actually attached to the actual handle object, like they ought to be. So that reattaching things in the right place. My daughter came in, that was about 15 years ago. Actually, it was in Perl 4 days. She looked over my shoulder and said, "What is that, swearing?" And of course, I was programming in Perl. She reads a lot of comic books, and so that's swearing to her. Or that's what I said back when she said that. I'm not sure. But we've been sensitive to this idea that punctuation is useful, but it should bear its weight. So in Perl 6, this is about all the punctuational variables there are. excuse me. And arguably, not counting the sigils, underscore is not punctuation because we classify that as alphanumeric. So there you go. But the idea is, you can have weird syntax, but save it for weird semantics. Make the normal variables look kind of normal. Those are kind of normal. Now, people still complain. They say, these sigils, they're ugly. Other languages don't use them. Why does Perl continue to do that? There's a couple arguments there. One of them is, well, a lot of natural languages either choose to mark their verbs specially or they choose to mark their nouns specially. A lot of Indo-European languages have gender and case markings. English has dropped a lot of those, except in the pronouns, which they get from the Vikings. The other argument for doing noun markers is actually, as we move into these other paradigms like object orientation or functional programming, we get stacked up verbs, get a lot of them, and so you get these noun phrases that have a single noun in them and a lot of verbs. So it's useful for, I should have picked a different color. Anyway, the dark red is the head of the noun phrase, and that highlights it a little bit here, but the fact that there's a sigil on that bit of it makes it easy visually to find out where do you start reading that phrase, regardless of whether you're programming left to right or right to left. So that is becoming more important over time. And, weird things should look weird. So we thought about the sigils a lot and looked at what Ruby did, for instance, with its sigils. And it actually does something entirely different than Perl. Perl uses its sigils for indicating the basic structure, whether it's a scalar or a positional or non-positional sort of container. Ruby, on the other hand, uses its sigils to indicate strange scoping, so things like class variables or globals or things like that. And we said, well, that's a good idea, but that sort of uses up your if you have a lot of different kinds of strange scopes, then that uses up your sigils very rapidly, and there aren't very many punctuational keys on the keyboard actually. We noticed an interesting thing, though, because if we keep the sigil, that opens up a little namespace here, one character big after the sigil. So we call the second character a twigil. I don't know. That's just what we call it. and it indicates that something weird is going on. So they look weird. That's good. They're weird. The first one there indicates a global variable or contextual. The question mark indicates a compiler constant, so like the current line number in your program. The next two indicate public and private attributes of objects. So an attribute that's named with dot foo actually has a method, dot foo, that's the accessor. And the bang one doesn't. And we have some what we call placeholder syntax, which is our self-declaring parameters, and they're just weirdly scoped variables. So this is another a scalable principle, and we give up something low-powered to gain something high-powered. Instead of having these punctuational variables, if we throw away the punctuational variables, then we can have these twiddles, and those actually turn out to be rather more powerful. So we get things like these, instead of having a dollar star special variable, which has been deprecated forever, we can have dollar star marking a global. Another thing we unified that with is this idea of contextual. We don't actually usually talk about globals in Perl 6 because our model is more like environment variables in Unix. You just say, well, I want this, it's more global to me, but I don't know how global it is. So if for something like your process ID, it probably is completely global. But different dynamic scopes can redefine your global context. So that turns out to be another very powerful unification. We thought a lot about all the punctuation, not just the sigils. For many years, people have said, well, why can't I leave the braces out like I can in C and C++ and Java? I sort of had irrational reasons for that. I don't like dangling syntax. Might explain why I don't like Python. With Perl 6, we discovered, well, there's a good reason for keeping the curlies. But if you keep the curlies, actually you can drop all the parens around your conditionals. It looks a lot cleaner, doesn't it? As long as you keep the white space in there, then the parser has no trouble keeping those separate. Notice also that we have a form here, .say. Instead of print. In Perl 5, there's this long list of functions which default to dollar underscore, and you sort of have to memorize them, or guess, which is worse. You don't have to guess, because there's none of the functions default to dollar underscore. If you want them to, you use the dot form, and it's one character which says this defaults to the current topic. It's a method call on the current topic. So you don't have to remember which things default dollar underscore. You don't have to remember which variables are magically global everywhere, because they just naturally happen. We have a marking for it. You don't have to remember in regular expressions. You don't have to remember which characters are metacharacters anymore, because if it's not alphanumeric, it's a metacharacter. We noticed we were using all of them up anyway. So we said, well, let's just take the rest of them. But that means we have quotes. So now if you want to quote something, just put quotes around it, and off you go. It ends up looking very clean. I could show you more from the standard grammar, but I don't have time. In Perl 5, you have anonymous subroutines. We didn't tell people they were closures, but they were. So in Perl 6, all blocks are closures. And you just write an anonymous subroutine like that, or like that, white space, because all blocks are closures. In Perl 5, think that means they're all anonymous subroutines in the abstract. If you're thinking in terms of Lisp, they're all lambdas. But basically, there's unification going on here. And there are no exceptions. There's not the built-in control structures that use blocks, they're still doing this in terms of all these closure semantics. And notice there was no semicolon here on the end of this. It's not a built-in sort of thing. It's just a block. But the fact that it ends the line with the right curly means you don't have to have the semicolon there. And that works on any end-of-line curly and on any syntax. The idea here is to be extensible. We don't care if random syntax there is a built-in or user-defined syntax. It's consistent, but it's extensible as the language mutates. How do we get a 100-year language? We make it mutatable over time. If you're from Lisp background, you say, well, how do you write a real lambda? Well, okay, if you take that lambda character and sort of turn it at 45 degrees, it kind of looks like that arrow there. But we like using the arrow notation here because it sort of indicates here's where the arguments come in and they get mapped to the signature. And that's just a signature. Those are the arguments to that block. So this sort of unification simplifies a lot of stuff that is hardwired into Perl 5. The grep map and sort syntaxes in Perl 5 are special cased. They just naturally fall out in Perl 6 because the first argument to the function is just another function. It's higher order programming with first class functions. And we have various ways of passing arguments in that look kind of like the special case. That we have these placeholder arguments, for example, with the caret. But those are just self-declaring parameters. So there's not these special cases like in Perl 5 where $A and $B are weird. It just naturally falls out. So we've got basically three ways of passing the parameter to your lambdas. You can have implicitly the current topic, which is dollar underscore, and then that's kind of like what you're used to in Perl 5. We have these placeholder variables, so you can explicitly say my argument is named A. And we have this explicit lambda pointy block notation. Now, the nice thing about that is that it doesn't have to be a single parameter. The for loop in Perl 5 can only take a single parameter. By swapping the argument list and the formal parameter to the block, to put the formal parameter next to the block, we can, or inside the block in the first case, then we get all this power that just drops out of it. And we can have multiple arguments to the block, and that just says take those arguments two at a time out of the list, or three or four, however many. Another laziness thing is this idea of progressive typing. You know, you don't want to think about types at the beginning. Most Perl programmers start thinking, you know, well, just scalars. So, you know, say pi is 3. You don't care. You know, as you get a little more sophisticated, you might want to, you know, enforce that anybody who uses pi thinks of it as an integer. So you can enforce that with some optional typing there. But it's lazy, again. You don't have to do it right off the bat. And these optional signatures sneak in at various points. Perl 5 has some of this in the syntax and mostly ignores the type. Perl 6 does not ignore the type. But mostly, I want to point out that the main place where the type signatures come in handy is within the signature of a function call for the formal parameters. And that's how we can do the multiple dispatch. And we're doing declarative language refinement here. So this idea of not being in two languages at once, the flip side of that is we always know in any lexical scope exactly what language we're in. I wish I had more time to go into that. But let's go on to the object system. There's a meta object protocol underneath, which allows us to do both prototype-based and class-based I/O. In fact, you consider that to be unified underneath. Each object knows what its meta object protocol is and can do the right thing. And our dispatchers for different object systems, whether you're doing single dispatch to a single object or this multiple dispatch thing to a set of parameters, or this idea of when you wrap up one function in another and wrap it and keep putting wrappers, it's just calling a sequence of, there's a sequence of candidates in any of these things, and a dispatcher is just something which picks one of those candidates and calls it, and it calls it just as a normal function because we've unified methods as functions. Underneath, methods really are just functions that happen to treat their first parameter as the invocant. Likewise, we've taken this idea of generics that many languages have and the idea of small talk traits, which we call roles, mixed them together, and also unified that with the idea of mixins as Ruby does it. The roles themselves are just basically parametric types. If we mix in things, if we mix in these roles, you get software reuse at compile time. Then we call those traits. You can mix them in at runtime, in which case they overlay any previous method declarations. Again, don't have time to go into that. You can, if you're familiar at all with Moose in Perl 5, that's basically based on the Perl 6 design for objects. And Rakuto is now able to play with these concepts also. Constraint types are just ways of getting even better definition when you're doing multiple dispatch. Sometimes you want to, you have one function that works on the even numbers and another function that works on the odd numbers, and you can define subsets of your types that do this. In the limit, every value is a subset type that happens to contain only one value. So that's another kind of unification. And that allows us to do this multiple dispatch. And that is the main motivation for putting types into Perl 6. It's not to do strong typing. It's to allow this do the right thing on the multiple dispatch. Smart matching. We have ordinary pattern matching like the first line there in Perl 5, except a lot of people can't remember whether it's equal tilde or tilde equal. So we just said, well, it's tilde tilde, and you don't have to. If you flip it the wrong way, it's okay. We generalize that to many things can operate as patterns, and they can decide whether to accept the value on the left. So a pattern can accept a value or reject it. With a number, is it the same number? With a string, does it match the string? So we get this smart matching idea that has been backported into Perl 5 now in 5.10. And we've unified the smart matching with the cases in a switch statement. So when you say when birthday, when asteroid or comet, when 42, that's just smart matching against the current topic, which is in dollar underscore, which is set by the given. And we've unified the topicalizer with switch statements, because all given does is set the current topic. It doesn't actually care whether there's wins inside or not. And since anything that sets dollar underscore is a topicalizer, this is more like the Perl 5 idiom of using for loop to set dollar underscore inside the block. But then you topicalize over a loop. We've unified switches with exception handlers. You have a switch that looks like this. If you happen to put an exception handler inside a block that catches your exceptions, then this will do a smart matching against the current exception. I don't know what a birthday exception would be, but I have a better idea what an asteroid exception would be, but I don't want to throw that one. So this progressive typing idea also plays into the impatience. We have native types, so you can have compact arrays that will run very fast and not take much memory. We will have the ability to declare shaped arrays, matrices, multidimensional, that can be very, that will be useful for PDL kind of applications. And we're coming into the age of mini-core, when there will be many, many possible threads running simultaneously. And so we want to support multiple styles of concurrency, not just, heavyweight threads, but a lot of lightweight threading ideas too. And the concept here is different problems that you're trying to solve, you want to make different promises as to what you care about and what you don't. I don't care that I have 5 minutes left. Yes, I do care. Hyperoperators, they're vectorizable, basically. They do the whole thing. So we have ways of taking an operator and saying, well, just apply it to all these values in parallel. And different DOMEI operations that will increase the dimensionality on one side or the other. Unary operators also. And a general hyperize whatever. It's higher order programming. Feeds are just pipes, but they're object pipes. So you can feed lists of objects from one thread to another, essentially. They're queues. Software transactional memory is something we're playing with. It remains to be seen how well it will actually scale in the real world. But junctions are, you've actually seen some of them there. They're, again, they're a way of entangling some data values together and then later observing them and getting a kind of a collapse. So you can say they've got this condition, x equals any of 1, 2, or 3. Well, you don't know what that means until you know x. But that all gets entangled together, and then the Boolean context actually determines what the truth of it is. And you can write it like this, too. We use them all the time, so we borrowed the vertical bar from the bitwise operators and demoted them to a longer Huffman coding. And you can write a match that says, well, and it reads just like in English, if A equals any of 1, 2, or 3. Then you write your switch statements. You can emulate a phone pad here, or actually, in my hotel room, I noticed that they were this way on the bottom there instead. And these are auto-threaded. By that we mean if they see an operator that doesn't know about junctions, they actually just do the right thing and calculate everything for all the possible values. So you can say if 1 or 2 plus 4 equals 5, and it knows what that means because it will calculate through here and say it'll distribute the 4 across those, and it'll say, well, okay, if 5 or 6 equals 5, or if it equals 7, a lot of functional programming support, which don't have time to talk about. But basically, blocks are all functions, methods are all functions, so we get all this higher order programming, the first class functions for free. All these meta operators that we talk about, they're just, again, taking a function and making variations on it. The hyper operators, reduce operators, assignment operators, which are hardwired in Perl 5, they're just a meta operator. Cross operators, reverse. You can write a factorial like this, just a reduce operator on star over a list. And in fact, that's shorter than saying factorial of whatever. So people just write this. Or if they get tired of writing that, they define their own postfix bang operator, which looks like that. That's all it takes. And then you can write 42 bang and get 42 factorial. And it all just works because user-defined operators have the same status. Any infix operator, including user-defined ones. Tildes are concatenation operators, so you can use a reduced concatenation. Are the arguments monotonically increasing? The user-defined operator, and you can reduce it just as easily. Cross operator, take everything against everything else in all possibilities. That can function as a meta operator and modify a star to cross-multiply everything. Cross-concatenate everything. So build a deck of cards. Make ace through king. Cross-concatenate that with of. Cross-concatenate that with spades, clubs, hearts, diamonds. And you've got your whole set of cards. And the new regular expression language is probably actually where we've done the most work in terms of revising how Perl 5 does it. We don't do string interpolation anymore. It's its own language. It's a lot more readable. All the brackets mean consistent things now. We stole the square brackets from character classes. A lot of metasyntactic reform. Match whites based like this. You write in Perl 5. You'd write it like that in Perl 6, except that's wrong because of all the Unicode white space. So you really should write that to match horizontal white space. Or in Perl 6, just write match horizontal white space. A to Z in Perl 5 ends up looking like that in Perl 6. But you really should write this, because even in Latin 1, A to Z is not going to match the accented characters. Basically, grammars, they're just rules. So grammars are to rules as classes are to methods. And I'm basically out of time, so I can't talk about this anymore. But this, the whole longest token matcher thing is just built into the regular expressions. And the basic idea is to make sure that all constructs are on equal footing. We do just-in-time lectures, and so I don't have time to talk about all that. basically, just to wrap up, my brother-in-law said, you know, I love iced tea. I went into this restaurant, and they promised me free refills. He said, so I said, oh, I'll have iced tea. And so they brought him his iced tea, and it was like 64 fluid ounce, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of milliliters, big. He said to me, they have a very curious way of discouraging refills. So that's the idea in Pearl 6. We want to have the most extensible language that anyone has ever made, and we want to build enough stuff in by default that people don't feel much need to extend it, so that it can scale and be all things to all people, which is, of course, impossible. I think I have negative time for questions, but you know, I'll be through here throughout all the other talks here, so. By the way, this is Camellia. Her larval form is the camel. And so this is actually a more or less a life-size picture. You don't want to get her angry.
Before you go out to get some food, if you haven't registered it and gotten one of these, you take the time to do it during your lunch if you can. Everybody who is registered for the Nordic Pearl Workshop, which has a card like this, gets a T-shirt. We'll move our T-shirts upstairs, and you can pick it up there. We have a list and cross you off it when you pick